Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies brought to you with the support of the ICON Research Center at the University of Warwick. This is part 2 of episode 29, where we're talking with Denise Rousseau about Herbert Simon's GMS classic on business goals. For part 1 and to get the text, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. If you haven't listened to part 1 yet, it may be worth going and doing so now, as this picks up right where we left off there. Now, back to the conversation.
I think another challenge is like in the military context, where it's the confluence of dozens of literature streams and fields of study, where we're trying to distill massive amounts of information and get it down just to try to even figure out what it is that we think that a future military leader needs, much less get into the development, the additional development of know-how knowledge, can be very difficult because all of the different fields of study are evolving themselves, and we're trying to keep up with each of them. And sometimes we wind up defaulting to what is because that's, or know what, because that's what we can produce sufficiently fast so that we can present something.
One of the things that I've found, and I like to think Herb might have been pleased with this, but that's probably a conceit on my part, is helping students interrogate the scholarly literature with practical problems so that they can go see the know what part, but bring their context and their questions to it, and then say, okay, you've done a quick appraisal of, you know, 5 relevant studies on your question, and your question had to do with, you know, the kind of work hours that would be effective for an ICU physician. So not a lot of my students are actually medical doctors in a management program. The issue for them is they already know the context. Then they interrogate the literature on what it says about work hours and quality, or work hours and stress levels. And reviewing the summary of the literature they've created from the perspective of their own experience, the know-how comes then. But that know-how has to be made in interrogating the literature against your problem, and then thinking about what the implications are, and what do you know now, and what remains uncertain. If you don't really have good evidence for every aspect of the problem you're trying to solve, what do you do when you don't really know? Well, you probably do some trial and error and some experimentation, but you recognize you're learning by doing. Helping them be a little bit more proactive in finding the literature for themselves and acting on it, as opposed to me trying to present it to them, which I can't present as many contexts as they will have, but I can help them make sense of the literature when they find it. So we actually, yeah. I train people to use Google Scholar and ask it practice questions, and we have a framework for making sense of it. And the big issue is their context and their need to know how helps them understand the what, the basic knowledge that's exists in a field of management practice, from structuring or motivating or employment onboarding practices and whatnot. They rub, shall we say, the practice issues with the science themselves.
Yeah, and that seems perfectly sensible, because, you know, coming back to this idea that management and organizations, that they're not out there to be interpreted,
right, they are there. They're in us.
Yeah, it's what we consider to be that what it largely will sort of end up being, especially if the person doing the considering is in a position of authority and power.
Yes.
But then we arrive at this dilemma that Herb alluded to in a very mysterious way about what kind of a footing can we base management as a profession or as an education discipline on, if this is kind of what we're dealing with fundamentally, the fundamental instability and flux of the concept. Not just in terms of what we think of individually, but kind of these waves that go with times that we started the discussion off with. And he mentioned there that even though he doesn't have the space to discuss this, But it seems that the prospect of some kind of a general theory of management that could be used, you know, to bring this all together is positive, or something to that effect that he said at the time of writing the paper, so in the late 60s.
It's sort of like Fermat's theorem, right? He doesn't have room to tell us, but he's got this great idea.
Yeah, it's there, but I'm not going to tell you what it is. And you address this in your paper as well. You kind of dissect this statement into its constituent parts and try to make sense of what is it that he's talking about.
Part of the issue, he was afraid, I think. No, not afraid. He saw that academics are self-interested and would teach what they like to teach. Clinical faculty are the generals of the last war, teaching what they did. And the student is not necessarily being well served by either acting on its own self-interest. So he said, could we structure the problems of management in a way that the students would get a more consistent framing up of what they needed to work on in their practice so that they would know how to look for the scholarship, make sense of their own experience or what practical advice they were getting from clinical faculty, and recognize that that they will learn over time if they keep practicing, but that we sort of needed to structure the domain better. I think to Herb, a lot of things always came down to information needs, and whether or not we would say today that that's the right way to do it, I don't know. But that we needed this overarching framework, and to remember that the student is taking this mental model of practice issues into the world in order to keep learning it once they've left. And so we have to help them understand what they're here to learn while they're in school so they can keep learning when they leave.
I'm just looking at this solution that Grand Intellectual Theory at the time that you wrote, and I'll read it out. So you say that it has two components, cultural and organizational practices that sustain a business school's full practice/science synthesis, and knowledge products that are unique to business schools. And then with regards to the former, you talk about design science and evidence-based management, which is one of your specialities. But with regards to the latter, that seems a bit more ambiguous, that what are these knowledge products that are unique to business schools?
A lot of research that we do in business schools, I mean, I say this as somebody in organizational behavior, but I think it's as true of my colleagues in finance or in economics, is in our fields more like basic research. It looks to test theory. It looks at general principles that apply in a domain and tests them against competing definitions of what might be going on. But practice-oriented research would be the notion of actually looking at the kinds of things that practitioners, let's say managers, do, and understanding the circumstances that motivate those behaviors and what might make it easier for the practitioner to perform better or to perform more ethically. And an example of this, you might recall, there was a classic study done in 1956, 57. It was Dearborn, Simon, and Gutskow. Dearborn and Simon, at any rate, where they looked at the executives in a class that Herb was teaching, and they looked at their approach to the case that was being solved. And what they found was that the personnel people saw personnel issues in the case. The finance people saw economic issues. The marketing people saw issues of sales, and that in effect, it was a different case depending on the functional background of people. And recognizing then that there are functional biases or role biases in the way managers define problems became one of the areas that then they would teach on to help people realize that perspective taking was a critical aspect of being an effective manager in an enterprise. So looking at what managers actually do, in that case, their behavior in the case class, was the kind of research that would be a knowledge product for professional education, would actually affect what we taught and make managers more aware of what maybe biases they would need to help themselves overcome.
So the knowledge product here is essentially a form of epistemology unique to the business school way of addressing...
Business school teaching in that case, yes.
Yeah. And what do you think that is? I mean, aside from everything you just said,
the critical idea, it's actually taking practice and studying practice. So there's a lot of medical research that looks at why doctors might overprescribe antibiotics to patients, even though we know that we have problems of resistance to drugs. Why do doctors still do this? And the research uncovered that physicians do it in part when they think they won't get to see the patient again, like when they're in an emergency room environment. So just in case that person who's coming in with a chest cold might actually have pneumonia, they'll give them a prescription for an antibiotic, whether they need it or not. And that insight led to the creation of a test, a blood test that could see if there was a protein in the blood that was an indication of infection. You can do that test on the spot and then know if you really need to give this person an antibiotic or not. So the idea was study why practitioners do what they do and study why they do some dysfunctional things as well as some things that might be more adaptive, and then create routines or practices that help them function better. And I think that's the kind of knowledge product that would be valuable in a business school to understand how decisions are made or how particular, let's say, dysfunctional approaches that might be used that have adverse effects on the environment or on employees, and help train our students to understand the predicaments that they might be in that might cause them to behave in a less ethical or a less responsible fashion. If we don't do this in business schools, who's going to do that kind of work, looking at the dilemmas of practice that cause people to behave in ways that we think of as undesirable or less appropriate or less socially beneficial?
It might be worth here reflecting on the different types of practices as well, because your description of studying medical practice, which is essentially a two-tier process where it is a management, which is supposed to be a profession of a different profession, and that other profession is grounded in, you know, a more objectivist, for lack of a better word, science itself, right? So the physiology and the chemistry and all that sort of thing. But if we're studying what managers do, so pure managers, as it were, there isn't such a grounding. So, and essentially what I'm getting at is that because management in many ways is a very hollow activity, very much centered on intuitions and gut feelings and previous experiences, then studying that as a profession does not yield the same results or efficacy as would be studying practices of things like medicine or engineering or some of these hard sciences.
How do we know until we look? We have a lot of conceptions of managerial practice, and we have the lovely, powerful work of somebody like a Henry Mintzberg, who and people who followed in his footsteps, who have helped us see with fresh eyes what the kind of the rapid fire, more intuitive work environment of many managers is. But if we're trying to create, so the issue was business school research. If we're trying to create research that helps our students, and I'm always going to go back and say our students, because I think that that's one of the opportunities that we have as business school scholars or professional school scholars, is to do research that adds to the quality of our teaching and what I would hope would be the quality of the whole person development of the people who graduate from our programs. It's the domains in which they function that I think our work is most important. Many managers are not professionals. They're people with a title. Many managers have no core knowledge base except what they've learned by doing. or think they've understood by learning. They're not necessarily my audience because they didn't go to Carnegie Mellon. The students who come to us know science, know far better than I do in many respects, how to do a host of different kinds of analytics. They're incredibly capable of that. That doesn't necessarily help them fully realize their potential. And as a business school faculty member, like Herb would say, I want my research or some of our research, not all, everything that I do is targeted to the student, but some things will be targeted because that's my opportunity as a business school faculty member is to learn about the circumstances in which they will work and help them find better ways of becoming reflective and gaining insight and debiasing themselves. And so the idea that we would do knowledge products that make it easier for professional managers to practice in an ethical way strikes me as very relevant. It's one thing to say, oh, managers, it's not really a moral profession. It's another thing to try to help some managers achieve exactly that.
The emphasis in what you said is more on individual capabilities rather
than... I'm an organizational psychologist, so that would be perhaps my bias. I think if we were talking with one of my wonderful finance colleagues, they might be thinking about rubrics and models of processes. And I could think about that under some circumstances, but I think right now a good bit of my own work, so I'll talk a little bit about my work, has to do with helping students learn to be critical thinkers, helping them be reflective about what they believe and then what the evidence around them tells them so they can, so to speak, update their priors, update from the initial assumptions they started with based on having good quality evidence and helping them work through that process. Because if this is what I'm going to teach, some of my research I'd like to dedicate to helping them achieve their learning goals.
No, but this is interesting. I want to stay with this for a bit because this idea that management education is fundamentally focused on managers or would-be managers or students, essentially individuals in any form that we would be willing to conceptualize them, I think it's not as common as it seems to be common sense. That makes sense because I think a lot of, and this is just kind of on the go reflections about what you said, that a lot of theory or models or case studies approaches that we have in this field of ours have to do with the emphasizing individual in favor of circumstances, unless we're dealing with the heroic leadership literature, which let's not deal with, and that's a whole other issue. And in this sense, what you said about teaching people and working with them through becoming ethical actors and moral actors makes more sense than if we're talking about this circumstantial and situational view of management, a little bit like Mary Parker Follett's law of the situation type of philosophy, that you have your situation and that is what determines the behavioral responses, as it were. There, ethics don't make sense because ethics is not a mechanical approach, right? Yeah. It's an individual practice.
Yes, so, and very much a reflective practice and a knowledge of self and also an aspirational practice of what do I value and what kind of world am I helping to contribute to. I do think that a large part of what business schools have the opportunity to do is to help people, regardless of what they think they're going to do in life, aspire to be moral leaders. And what form does that take? And partly it gets back to the issue, I go back to Fayol, not necessarily overvaluing their own authority as a person with a powerful position, but perhaps their own authority as somebody responsible for the actions that they take and responsible for the consequences they have on others. And that idea that people can come to understand how what effects they have as individuals in an organization, these social constructions are incredibly powerful. Can we help them see in some more systematic way how they do affect others? And that's where the science is very helpful because we do have very good understandings of sort of behavioral contingencies and forces that shape people's behavior and frame of reference. So one of the things I like about teaching organizational behavior to students is it's not just about how you influence others, but also how you come to understand why you do what you do.
I'm going to take that. Thank you. In my teaching practice, because I think it's fundamental, really.
Well, one of the things about we've been talking about the individual students, and I know that I'm going to kind of veer away from the business school as the context, but I'm also thinking about, say, like some of the things that we do, which are oriented towards short programs geared towards organizations. Say that, on the one hand, we have education that's oriented on the individual to prepare them to be managers and senior leaders. But there's also commensurate with it, programs which we offer organizations to help guide the collective team to function better. And I'm just kind of curious, we haven't talked about that kind of a situation in the business education or other professional education context. I just wonder if that sort of a program or problem manifests itself differently within the context of what Herbert Simon was talking about.
Oh, I think they're very, very, very similar in a lot of ways, though. Of course, when you have a program that's designed for the development of an organization where people already know each other and have a common focus, it's a little bit easier to bring the problem into the classroom or into the learning process because they share background. And the really fun aspect there is to try to get some, I call them like tracer problems, problems that kind of trace through the organization and make that an analysis of that from the perspective of science, organizational data, stakeholder points of view, and ethics, make that the focus of discussion.
But there's also, one of the things that I get concerned about is if the organization itself is a little bit too homogeneous in the way that it behaves. And then end up reinforcing bias, or in the program, if you're trying to, try to kick them out of the box or out of the box that they've put themselves in, it can be, it can actually be very difficult.
It's absolutely true. And I do think, especially if you get top management teams who often all look alike and wear the same clothes and are usually the same gender, can discuss alternatives, points of view, they become very limited. So I do think that has to be set up very well. Those are probably less fun programs to teach unless there's been a real commitment on the part of the leader to make himself, herself vulnerable.
And sometimes I find that to be a bit of a problem. When I've done these sorts of programs in the past, I've found that in a certain way, it's almost while it's espoused that this is supposed to be team building, it's supposed to be educational, what have you, the leader goes in as sort of like the pontificator, if you will. And tries to, in the process of setting the tone, actually kind of influences the educational environment in a perhaps negative way.
So we probably have some obligation in this context to do an intake and not to take all organizations or groups that say they want to come for training, because it is not a lobotomy. You don't fix people. That you really do need to have a process where people are open and primed to explore. And so it may be better to constitute it differently or not take the job. I really don't feel my role as a business school faculty member is to reify somebody's power position. I think that my job is to help them, just like I try to work on myself, complexify themselves in Carl Weick's terms. Yeah. And there have to already be some fault lines that are being exposed and discussed in that group of people for that to happen.
How do you feel about the notion that in those types of programs where networking is the end to itself?
Well, that's not necessarily a bad thing. It's actually easier if people are coming together as a community. They know about each other, but they don't have ties, and they want those ties. If they're not super tied to each other already, like a more closed top management team, I think you can actually make some interesting learning experiences for them because they do have different frames of reference.
Yeah, the reason why I ask that is because sometimes that becomes the end to itself to the point where that's what is communicated as the reason for getting everybody together. And then everybody goes into the event wondering, okay, why am I here? Why couldn't I have done this some other way?
Right. That's probably not a proper executive program. You could do that in a lot. You could have somebody else facilitate it. You don't need a faculty member doing that.
Yeah. If, for example, let's say that, you know, when you look at a setting or, you know, such as that, how do you know that you've been effective? What are the kind of outcomes that you're looking for?
That's a very good point. That's a very good point. So one of the things, and this goes to the broader question that, with Demetrius that we've been discussing, and that has to do with what are the learning goals? And of course we know, that if you don't set a goal, you're less likely to really accomplish anything. The old problem of just having a do your best frame of reference. So I think the idea of articulating learning goals is really important. And the idea to get people to articulate their learning goals, we're talking about an executive program, at the outset of the session so that we can revisit those as we go through and say, well, are we making progress on this? Are you gaining an insight in this area? What's different now? And to do some periodic, if we have a whole day together or 3 days together, periodic checks on progress made or insight gathered against a set of learning goals. I actually find that that's a really important tool because learners will reference for themselves their own goals if the goals are made salient. And it doesn't matter too much if they have somewhat different goals because they're using them as their lens for our interaction in our class.
What you're talking about, I can think about learning goals in two ways, is sort of like the performance there at the event itself, and then perhaps the long-term effectiveness. Is there, you know, follow-up or?
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I like to do, because I do believe that if we do a good job, people are still learning after the class is over and they're processing. Hopefully we want this spill over, this long reach. Because there's a lovely website. This is just a mechanical thing, but I hear that it has some value to our students. Is I have people write a letter to Future Me. So Future Me is a website that you can set up an email message to yourself some weeks or some months ahead with a reminder of what it is you wanted to be doing or wanted to be working on. Mm-hmm. And I the idea of having that kind of check in with yourself on are you making progress is kind of, that's a hallmark of almost all developmental programs and efforts is that kind of follow up. Here's a way that we can make it happen, even in an executive class where we don't necessarily have a long-term relationship with people. But I do think it's very important to articulate learning goals and to find ways of measuring them, even if imperfectly, because the measurement is a further prompt to reflect.
Okay. And now I'd like to segue into a different setting, which I know I'm sure you've probably experienced pressures in this arena, but the advent of distance education.
Oh, yeah.
And what I'm curious is, you know, if, you know, like in your article, you channeled Herbert Simon, would you channel him again and say, how would he react to the pressures and some of the pedagogical challenges that distance education presents, say in, you know, a business school environment or in our case, a military education?
Well, I think an interesting issue, because remember, Herb is thinking about what can we routinize and what needs to be interactive and more feedback driven and improvisational. One of the beauties, I think, of distance educations, you know, so usually some format of online education, is that you can mix and match well-designed educational modules that that take people through problems. They give it an answer. They get feedback if they did it right. They reflect, then they do it again, and they're able to learn. So my evidence-based management training, I have 5 different modules that students can complete on their own that teach things that would be a little bit boring if I tried to do it in class, but kind of fun as an exercise with pictures and feedback, because then I can flip my classroom. And so when we are connected to each other on our media, we can talk about what they went through with the exercise and how that connects to the work they're doing now. So we have a much more dynamic interaction rather than another lecture. Mm-hmm. So the idea of the flipped classroom, I think, is hugely important. The other thing, as I teach several online classes that deal with evidence-based management, and what's nice about these is, since I'm usually talking with people who are practicing managers, is the discussion boards are, I read them once a week and feedback and da-da-da, but the students are reading them as they go along, and they're commenting and asking questions of each other. And I find it really puts more organizational and contextual clothing on the issues we're talking about, because they're raising their questions of each other and using our concepts and querying. And I love that. That would be so much more difficult in a classroom with 30 people, where if I have an online class with 12, the discussion board's very manageable. And then the next month I have another 12. The quality of interaction, I think, can be greater with the right setup and the right priming. So I see it as this whole challenge of distributed education is with good design, really a nice opportunity.
Yeah, which and the with good design was kind of where I was going to go next, because obviously there's in other, in other schools or what have you, there's tremendous pressure to set up, say, distributed because of the assumptions about it being more perhaps efficient or cost effective or what have you. It's not always the case that the energy can go into that that kind of a design. So how do you overcome that?
Yeah. That's a mistake. There are such a thing as design flaws, and design flaws crash airplanes and cars, and design flaws erode the quality of educational programs. And so part of the issue is, I think that when one, I'm very fortunate to be at Carnegie Mellon, and we have something called the Open Learning Initiative. And what that is about is designers at our Everly Center who actually will take our class content and structure it according to what the evidence base says are appropriate learning principles, you know, how to chunk exercises, how to break out the feedback. There's a natural progression of insight and understanding, how to give people feedback at the end. Things that they've actually changed the way I teach, because I learned the design principles from helping them set up my online class. So now even my face-to-face class, I do certain checks that I might not have done before, but I saw the advantage of doing it in the online class. I would not get into this space unless I was committed to go in to do it with quality, because otherwise I think we risk, first, we're violating a trust. We're educational institutions, and there is a trust that we're providing quality. And the second issue is, on how can it ever be appropriate for an educational institution not to use what the research evidence says is good pedagogical design? How can we not be using that and call ourselves universities or colleges? I think there's a that's an ethical issue for us.
Yeah, and that's a very good point. Let me just ask one final question on that, because this also is not something I really saw in Herb's paper. But what you're discussing, I mean, you almost have to have a climate or an environment that is conducive to that type of a design. And so, to what extent do you think that the administration, the environment that's set by the administration fosters the ability to develop this curriculum the way that you wish?
Oh, it's hugely important. And I'll be honest. And when Herb was alive, there was a variation on the Open Learning Initiative that was designed towards educational assessment at Carnegie Mellon. And if you wanted assessment done in your classes, these people, which he got the university to fund, would come and help you do that. And they were always underfunded, and there was never enough of them. When Herb died, they killed the initiative because the university didn't have the sponsor anymore. But lo and behold, 15 years after he passed away, it's back because now we know the criticality of assessment, and now we have this wonderful open learning initiative, which has really brought a lot of talent to the university in educational design. So I think Herb would be smiling. They couldn't keep idea down.
I think this is actually a good way to wrap this up with this wonderful sentiment.
This was a pleasure, gentlemen. Thank you very much. I enjoyed talking with you.
Thank you so much for joining us. It's been super wonderful and an absolute pleasure.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much, Denise.
And that's all for episode 29, the penultimate episode of the Journal of Management Studies Classics series. Wow, very exciting. Thank you so much for listening, and we hope you're enjoying these conversations and this one in particular as well. And if you do, as per usual, please share the podcast with your students, colleagues, and friends. I'd like to remind that as of tomorrow, as of 1st of June, we are running a first ever Talking About Organizations prize draw, where by going and leaving a feedback for the podcast on iTunes or any other podcast directory that you may be listening on, you will be automatically entered into a draw to win a signed copy of The Stupidity Paradox by Mads Alvesen and Andre Spicer. Mads has been a guest on episode 28, and he's going to be a guest on another forthcoming episode. And he has very kindly donated a special signed copy for us to give to one of you lucky listeners. So all you have to do is go and leave a review. We'll get an automatic notification, and then we'll select one listener at random and send you the book. It's very exciting, very cool thing, and we hope to maybe do this as a more regular occurrence in the future, if this works out and if there is enough engagement for us to do this. Next week, we'll have a summary of this episode, and then the final episode 30 of the Journal of Management Studies Classics, focusing on the work of Hugh Wilmot, here on Talking About Organizations.